When I was just a tyke, cowboy actors were marketed as role models for little backyard cowpokes like me. And we could send off to get a certificate, making us pals of the saddle or some such with Roy Rogers, Hopalong Cassidy, or others. Cute for a 4-year-old, less so for 57-year-old Jeff Spaceboy Bezos. Yet, the gabillionaire profiteer, labor exploiter, and tax scofflaw who heads the Amazon online retail syndicate was all dressed up in July, play-acting as a heroic conqueror of space. Little Jeff took an ego trip on his very own rocket ship, publicizing it as some combination of Wright Brothers innovation and Apollo moon landing. But the whole thing took only 11 minutes, barely made it to space, achieved no scientific purpose, and did zero to enhance American prestige in the world. As for personal genius or heroics, Bezos didn't invent or build the spacecraft, didn't have any role in flying it, and he faced no cosmic unknowns. He didn't even have to wear a spacesuit. All he really did was to buy the spacecraft. But he did get to dress up in a sort of space-style jogging outfit, with his name and his corporate logo emblazoned on it. Then, like a little boy getting a cereal box certificate proclaiming him a cowboy, when the diminutive mega-billionaire floated back to terra firma, he held a fake ceremony at which some former NASA official pinned a set of phony astronaut wings on him. More pathetically, his corporate lobbyists are said to be appealing to Washington officials to award official astronaut wings for what amounted to a rich man's carnival ride. This is Jim Hightower saying, so there you have the new pantheon of America's flight heroes, the Wright brothers, Amelia Earhart, John Glenn, and Jeff Spaceboy Bezos. Did I mention pathetic? The Hightower Radio Lowdown is brought to you by the Lowdown Happy Hour, live streamed from the Chat and Chew Cafe. Details at HightowerLowdown.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I got to tell you, I like the response of Senator Dick Durbin, who's the Senate Judiciary Chairman, talking about the ex-acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen. He said the testimony was frightening information and that he told us a lot. And look, in 7 hours of talking, there's got to be a lot, because he was attacked. He was only the acting attorney general for a very short period of time after Billy Barr bailed. So 7 hours. I still want to know what came out. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on what possibly may have been the reason and what we're going to get out of Rosen's testimony. I've asked our good friend Renato Mariotti to come talk with us. Renato's a former federal prosecutor and host of the fabulous On Topic podcast, also one of our friends over at the MSW Media podcast site. Renato, thanks for taking time for us.
Absolutely, anytime.
So this is a big deal. Rosen coming out and not being subpoenaed, not being compelled, I guess, in any way to testify, jumped out before he was denied the ability. This is kind of a big deal, I think.
I think so, too. And, you know, this is what it looks like when somebody actually wants to tell the American people what happened. You know, we had a lot of posers of sorts during the Trump administration. They acted like they desperately wanted to tell the public, but they wouldn't, right? Whether it was John Bolton or, you know, we had his former White House counsel, you know, who essentially would sit and hand-wring about, oh, there might be executive privileges and that. Here you have somebody who wants the public to know, and you can see the difference.
Yeah, and I would have loved to have seen the testimony, and I hope at some point we get to find out what exactly was 7 hours long worth of testimony. But you're right, there were a lot of people leaking things. There were a lot of, and it was driving Trump crazy, but there were a lot of people sounding the alarms. It just, you know, a lot of people weren't listening.
Yeah, that's right. And I will say one thing about Rosen. There's also an element to which he, when the chips were down, he actually made the right choice. So I give him credit for that as well, because he was given an opportunity, effectively, to join an attempt to overthrow our way of life in the United States, our system of government. And he stood against that and took, I think, some important action there. But one thing that scares me, Rick, is the way in which, you know, that was so much based on one man and how he acted. And we can't rely. What scares me is what happens when we have somebody else there who makes a different choice. What could that mean for our country?
No, that's incredible. And, you know, I had asked someone over the weekend, how if they believed how close we were to them pulling this off. And he said, you have no idea.
Yeah, it really looked like they were damn close. And what they were doing is essentially, you know, Trump was going to use the Justice Department to try to give cover and direct state legislatures to help him steal the election. And what's, I think, scary about it is how close, you know, as you say, it was to working, and how also, Trump said, just put the statement out there and let us handle the rest. There's a sense that these lawyers, they didn't even really need to do something that was really crazy. This wasn't like they were going to, you know, alter the ballots or steal ballots. It's not going to be ballots thrown in the river. This is essentially just putting out this statement that, oh, yeah, you know, it might be legal for you to say that, you're going to appoint your own electors, or there are maybe some irregularities that we're looking at, you know, in kind of a very mealy-mouthed statement, something that a lawyer might, you know, somebody less ethical might, clearly there's somebody, some folks in this administration willing to sign off on, that may have been enough to start and fuel the sort of train that we've already seen of Trump claiming the election was stolen and actually trying to steal it.
Yeah, and the other scary part of this is how many people would have been okay with it.
Well, yeah. I mean, we already have 40% of the country, or 35%, still believing he's the president, acting as if he's the president. I do think, I think this has a profound impact on our democracy because, let's face it, there is a pretty good chance that we're not going to hold all the levers of government in the not-too-distant future because we have such slim majorities.
Yeah,
it's certainly a possibility.
Yeah, I mean, where I've been is I'm in this mindset, and I said this from the very beginning, that they're never going to hold them accountable. Trump's never going to be held to account for this. And my fear becomes, 2022 comes around, this it ramps up, whatever, but it doesn't come to an end point where we're actually holding him accountable. Republicans take the Senate and the House back. Now we're looking at impeaching Biden for no reason or some chumped up reason. And then the steal is complete because they've already shown the hand. They want to impeach Biden and Harris and make Trump the Speaker of the House to make him president again. I mean, they've told us the plan.
Yeah, absolutely. I absolutely think their goal is to essentially make it so that Biden fails, that the government doesn't work, and to bring back the circus. And I will say, you mentioned that Trump's not being held accountable. I think one reason why is because the things that he does, the way in which he was able to propagandize, puts him in a spot where he does these things that don't neatly fit the crimes that we have put in the law books.
Right.
He's not, like, people did not conceive of the thought that merely having DOJ attorneys put out a statement about irregularities and this and that could constitute voter fraud. And it makes it a weird thing to try to prosecute because our prosecutions are usually about somebody cooking the books in some way, altering the tabulation in some fashion or some, or doing something of that nature, not putting out a vaguely worded statement that would give cover for a bunch of crazies to try to steal the election. It's really unprecedented in American history. And I do, somebody who loves our country and loves our democracy, it's a scary thing.
No, it's frightening. And it's frightening that so many people were able to be duped into it and fall for it. And look, I still know people today who, as you pointed out, still think he was the rightful winner, and you're never going to convince them otherwise. So, statements, maybe we get to see what Rosen's statements were, but, statements like the one last week where, like you said, you just put out a statement, let us do the rest. They don't see that as a problem. They see that as, no, we're going to go and mobilize people and we're going to go, protest. And no, sure, they're going to go and do what they did on January 6th.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the plan here was to try to give cover and convince mainstream Republicans in these states that they could just ignore the will of the people and appoint a slate of electors that were not voted for by the people. That's what he tried to get the Michigan Republican Party to do, and to their credit. And I give credit to people who, you know, I understand that some people, I'm sure there's going to be folks listening who are going to say, well, how do you give credit for someone for doing the right thing, right? Not cheating, not stealing, not whatever. Well, I do give credit for when they're pressured by the president.
Yep.
You know, Michigan Republicans are trying to help them steal the election. I'll give them that. But it's a scary thing because we are more and more the reasonable people are getting driven out of that party.
No, I mean, and the guy who was the Secretary of State of Georgia, that Brad Raffson part purger, I give him the credit of you know, one, you know, not kowtowing to the president's demand, but also coming out and saying this is what happened. Now, I believe Raffson Parger did do everything he could do to steal the election by purging people from the voting rolls and doing all of that stuff. He tried to, you know, do as much as they could to get as many people, especially those people, thrown off the voting rolls to rig the election to begin with. But when it came down to actually going and, you know, searching for another 12,000 votes, he's gone, no, that's a bit too far, even for me.
Yeah, I think there's certain lines that, you know, that used to be considered that we will cross. In other words, sure, we're willing to, do all sorts of things to try to convince people not to vote. But once the numbers are in, the numbers are the numbers. And, you know, Trump essentially took the norms and traditions of American democracy and blew them up. And he, I think, you know, acted in a counter-democratic way and did so using tools that propaganda decides to use. Things, you know, telling big lies, repeating lies, you know, trying to get people to disbelieve anyone but him as a source of truth. And I don't know about you, Rick, but I have family members who get caught up in that. I know people, and I have to deal with that on a regular basis, folks who don't believe anyone but Trump and sort of a very limited group of people. It's a concern that is not going to go away anytime soon.
No, and I know people like that as well. And what's frightening is, I look at Trump as a con man. He was always a con man in my view. I followed him, you know, on his rise in New York, and I used to listen to him on Howard Stern all the time and go, how does anybody even take this guy seriously? And yet you've got, you know, working class people who are looking at this grifter billionaire, or maybe billionaire because we don't really know, as the savior of the working class. It's just some kind of bizarre alternative world that they're in. And I come back to the media structure in this country that created him. He didn't create the environment that we're in now. It was created. He was just smart enough to use it in the way that he did.
Yeah, I think that's right. And in his whole persona, of course, was, I think, in part created by a television show and various other things, right? He was not the successful businessman, perhaps, that he was led us to believe, at least based on some of the important investigative reporting that was done. But look, I mean, what concerns me more are the more able, in my opinion, more dastardly, more frightening, in my view, people who are trying to follow in his footsteps, whether it's Ron DeSantis or Josh Hawley,
yep,
or plenty of others. The J.D. Vance, people who know better or should know better, but want whatever it is, right? They want power. They want to be in charge. They want whatever they want, and they're willing to try to copy his playbook as much as possible.
Yeah, that's the scary part in all this. And the hope is we get to the bottom of this. Now, obviously, you watch this closely, like others. As a former federal prosecutor, you have kind of an insight that many people don't. What are you paying attention to in the coming weeks and months? Because I still don't believe that he's going to be held accountable. I still don't believe that there are going to be any prosecutions coming out of this at the upper levels, maybe at the lower levels. But I don't think you're getting Trump or any of the crime syndicate there. What are you paying attention to? And do you think that it's possible to go after the folks there at the top?
Yeah, so I'm paying attention to the Manhattan DA case. I do think that that will ultimately result in issues for the Trump organization. I don't think it will be for Trump or his family personally.
Nope.
So I'm interested in that. I would watch the Fulton County case. Okay, I do think that that has the potential, or the D.C. Attorney General. Those cases have some, those kind of state cases, so to speak, have some, I think, legs. On the federal side, frankly, some of the stuff that I think would be the most likely to prosecute Trump was the stuff we already know about, like the obstruction of justice and the Mueller report. But it doesn't seem to be the Garland Justice Department has a lot of interest in pursuing that we could see. I think that this new activity we've heard about, while it may be the most evil thing that Trump has done, although it's hard to compare evils, right? This is a guy who took children away from their parents, okay? So, you know, whatever it ranks in the level of evil that we're talking about here, it's hard, like I said, to fit into a traditional criminal statute. And I know there's people, I'm sure there's somebody on television who's claimed that this just is absolutely X, Y, or Z, but it definitely doesn't fit neatly into traditional prosecutorial model. So I'm not so sure that this is going to result in any prosecutions. It may, but I like you. I wouldn't bet on it. And I think people who are listening to this need to not sit back and expect some prosecutor to save us from these threats to our democracy. We all have to work at a grassroots level to fight this stuff and to build a winning coalition.
No, because the fear is that the game plan that they've told me is in the works. Them taking over the House and Senate and installing Trump as Speaker, because you don't have to be a representative, and then making him president. That's the game plan. They've already told us. But you brought up Garland there for a moment, and I haven't been overly thrilled with Garland's interest in going after these crimes. And I never thought he was going to. I've always seen him as a very moderate guy. What kind of grading thus far would you give Merrick Garland?
It's hard to tell because I don't know everything that's going on internally. For all I know, they're going to announce the indictment tomorrow. I don't know. I think what's disappointed me is that there has not been at least any overt, that I'm aware of, public reckoning with what happened over the last 4 years at the Justice Department. What I wanted to see was an effort by the Justice Department to come forward and say there was a problem, structural problem, during the Trump years, where Trump was using the Justice Department to further his own ends. There was no wall. There's no separation between the president and the attorney general. The attorney general was acting as a personal attorney for the president. And we were taking actions that, that benefited certain of the president's friends, associates, co-conspirators, whatever you want to call them, his crowd. And we are going to do the following things to ensure that this doesn't happen again. Or at the very least saying, here is our public statement about what happened. We as a country can never let this happen again. Congress, we call on you to do X, Y, Z, whatever it may be, whatever can constitutionally be done to try to ensure that this doesn't happen again. And I'm disappointed that conversation hasn't happened. And I don't know why it has not, but it should.
No, I'm disappointed on a lot of fronts. But I'm still hopeful. There's still part of me that goes, some of the recent revelations possibly going to move in a direction that I don't believe possible. But I'm the ever optimist, still very hopeful. But as this continues, I'd love to have you come back and share some thoughts and share your expertise on this. I appreciate the time, Renato.
Anytime, Rick.
Good stuff. Renato Mariotti, former federal prosecutor, host of On Topic podcast. Make sure you check that out over at MSW Media, where we are now one of the member shows there. A good company to be in. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1978. That was the day President Jimmy Carter declared a federal health emergency at Love Canal in the city of Niagara Falls, New York. Premier spokeswoman, housewife Lois Gibbs, became the poster child for the citizens' environmental justice movement virtually overnight. Niagara Falls Gazette journalists had broken the story 2 years earlier. Residential sump pump testings and health surveys found a number of toxic chemicals and unusually high rates of cancers, birth defects, miscarriages, and other serious health concerns. Initially planned as a canal, the site remained abandoned until the 1940s. That's when Hooker Electrochemical Plant and the city began using the site to dispose of toxic chemicals and municipal waste. More than 20,000 tons of toxic sludge containing more than 21,000 chemicals were buried there. Then, in 1953, the city school board bought the site and built two schools on the property. Soon, about 1,000 families settled nearby. By the early 1970s, residents complained of foul odors, health issues, substances filling their basements, and leaky waste disposal drums popping up in their backyards, killing all plant life. Carter's initial declaration provided limited funding, but the disaster led to the passage of the Superfund Act. The neighborhood was demolished, and residents were compensated and relocated. The new owner of Hooker Chemical, Occidental Petroleum, settled with the EPA for $129 million. Despite 21 years of remediation and residential redevelopment, new residents complained in 2011 of foul odors and ruptured sewer lines oozing toxic sludge. By 2014, 1,000 new complaints had been filed, contending the area had never been properly remediated.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So it looks like the hospital up in Massachusetts, it's St. Vincent Hospital, where the nurses have been on strike. Some 700 nurses of the Massachusetts Nurses Association. Evidently, they're hiring more scabs. Going to bring in more replacement nurses. Ultimately, trying to force the negotiations in their favor. And this is one of those things where you go, at some point, isn't it worth sitting down, hammering out your differences, and maybe giving a little bit more so that you don't have to bring scabs in and you don't have to bring in temporary people. You don't have to rile the community, and you don't have to spend the kind of money that you're spending on these scab nurses. But again, this is, we talked about this last week. This isn't about the wages. This isn't about any of that stuff. It's about the power, because as I understand, and we talked with someone a couple of weeks ago about this strike. It's about staffing levels. It's about the kind of treatment that, that nurses get on the job. Now, what's interesting is, like I said, had they just, negotiated and done some of the things they needed to do, probably would have saved money. In fact, the Boston Globe reported that the company that owns St. Vincent Hospital, not a Massachusetts company, a company, I guess, from Texas, that they've spent in excess of $100 million to force this strike to happen and to prolong it, where they could have come to an agreement. That $100 million, and I gotta ask, had you just said, we're just going to throw another $100 million at this contract, how fast would those nurses have said yes? How fast, how many additional nurses could you have added to bring staffing levels down for $100 million? Break that up over a five-year contract. That's $20 million a year that you could have spent on staffing instead of, hiring union busting scab nurses to come in at really exorbitant rates. And look, I've seen this stuff happen firsthand, in the area where they were breaking one of the unions that were represented one of the nursing homes. They brought people in. They were paying paying the nurses on the floor like somewhere between 14 and 16 bucks an hour. they brought scab nurses in for like 70, 75 bucks an hour, plus their per diems for meals, plus their housing allowances to stay locally, plus transportation. The money was just enormous. Wasn't about the money. It was about the power. It was about corporate America saying, nope, we don't want to answer to anyone. We don't want our workers having any rights. We don't want them having any say. We want none of that. And they'll spend the money to do it. And this is, you know, fortunately in Massachusetts, they've done a really good job here recently of dealing with the virus, and the numbers haven't spiked. Imagine if we're in the middle of an Arkansas kind of explosion. Imagine if we're in a Florida kind of spike at this moment, and you've got these nurses who are, well, I'll be honest, they would have come back to take care of the patients. But this is one of those moments where, you know, realistically, how much power and control do these companies have? And in a hospital setting, this is where privatization fails. But I'm curious. And again, this is one of those moments where you go, how far will this company go? How far will they go to impose their will? How much money will they spend? Because again, these companies are so big. They have such enormous war chests. They can easily take on 700 workers. Amazon could easily take on 5,000 workers at a warehouse in Alabama. Warrior Met Coal can easily take on 1,100 striking miners in Brookwood, Alabama. Could easily outlast them and try and starve them out so that they take a subpar contract. Just happy to have a job. Just glad to be here. I know we've been trained like that, in that mentality. I know the vast majority of people have been trained in, well, I'm just taking what they're given because I'm working for a living. Yeah, we heard that crappy song all during the 80s. And all during every recession, every downturn, every time something happens, I'm just happy to have a job. Even if it is in poverty wage scenarios, exploitable condition scenarios, desperation, where the corporate class likes us. So as I said, you know, union busting, that is the corporate way, which again, for me, is the reason why we need to have comprehensive labor law reform. And now, this should not be allowed to happen. This kind of thing shouldn't be done. But this is 21st century America. Looks a lot like 19th century. Scary, sad stuff. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
America can't wait any longer. Our roads and bridges are crumbling beneath our feet.
Looks like Infrastructure Week is finally happening. County in Washington State passes America's first ever ban on new fossil fuel infrastructure. Plus, massive new wildfires force evacuations in Greece, Turkey, and Italy.
All of those stories and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
I am not worried. I live in California. The coronavirus in the air is killed by the smoke from the fires. So I...
See? Everything works out just fine. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, maybe... we're actually going to see an infrastructure bill passed? Really?
Maybe.
Maybe.
But first, a wildfire's aftermath has led to the closure of a major U.S. interstate highway indefinitely. Interstate 70 through the Rocky Mountains near Glenwood Springs, Colorado, has been shut down after torrential rains caused a massive mudslide on a mountain slope that burned in last year's record wildfire season, trapping about 100 motorists in their cars overnight.
Really?
Now, all were evacuated safely, but Colorado officials called the mudslide damage, quote, unlike anything we've ever seen before.
And I have driven many times on that Interstate 70 through Glenwood in Colorado. It is beautiful. It's shut down indefinitely?
Yes, it could take months to repair.
Wow.
And now requires hours-long detours, some through Wyoming.
Oh, man.
So that climate-related shutdown arrives just in time for Infrastructure Week.
Yay!
Which appears to be actually happening for reals this time after becoming a running joke in the Trump administration. Senate Democrats released details of the nearly $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill, which contains $550 billion in new spending over 5 years to repair the nation's crumbling roads, bridges, water, and wastewater infrastructure, including replacing all of the nation's lead service lines. Environment-related provisions include billions in funding for passenger rail and public transit, an electric vehicle charging network, all-electric school buses, cleanup of Superfund and brownfield sites, transmission lines and modernizing the electric grid, carbon capture technologies, advanced battery research, drought mitigation, and coal mine cleanup and reclamation.
This is a big deal, and it's the smaller of the two infrastructure packages they're talking about.
Yes, if this bipartisan bill attracts 10 Senate Republican votes to win passage, it would constitute the largest investment in America since the 1950s. However, Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell on Monday indicated that Republicans plan to drag out the process.
Uh-oh.
Our full consideration of this bill must not be choked off by any artificial timetable that our Democratic colleagues may have penciled out for political purposes.
Well, too bad. Take as long as they want. Chuck Schumer is not letting them go home for their August recess until they pass this bill.
Now, remember, this is separate from the much larger $3.5 trillion Democrats-only budget reconciliation deal, which can be passed in the Senate with a simple majority vote. But conservative Democratic senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona both have been saying that they have issues with that $3.5 trillion price tag.
Oh, they have issues, all right.
In other news, the climate hits just keep on coming. Last week, Greenland's ice sheet saw a surge in melting during another Arctic heat wave in a single day, releasing enough meltwater to cover the entire state of Florida in 2 inches of water.
Wow.
Six regions around the world are now grappling with massive wildfires driven by extreme heat and drought intensified by man-made climate change. The U.S. West, Ontario, Canada, Russian Siberia, and now a ring of fire around the Mediterranean as more than 800 wildfires burn in Greece, Turkey, and Italy, causing hundreds of millions of dollars in damages and forcing the evacuations of thousands from tourist resorts.
You know, this climate change thing is starting to be a problem.
But some good news. Renewable energy was the second biggest source of electricity generation in the U.S. in 2020, surpassing polluting coal and coming in second only to natural gas, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. Renewables were responsible for about 21% of all electricity generated in the U.S. in 2020. Natural gas was number one at around 40% of output.
Natural gas, we're coming for you.
Finally, a victory for activists and anything that breathes in Washington State, the Whatcom County Council just voted to permanently prohibit the approval of any new fossil fuel infrastructure and restrict expansion of existing fossil fuel facilities. The move was spearheaded by new council members who in 2013 worked to defeat a polluting coal export facility and then decided to run for office in their own community.
Nice. Elections matter. Way to go, Whatcom County. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Well, Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Evidently, someone sent Pope Francis 3 bullets via the mail. I guess it was what the report is. It was intercepted near Milan. Evidently, the postage address came from France. So, hey, who really wants to put their karma, their afterlife in that kind of peril? That you're going to threaten the Pope? How bad have things gotten? How bad off are you that you're going to threaten the freaking Pope? Crazy, crazy times that we live in. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the crazy times that we live in, I've asked our good friend, former Ohio Congressman and political analyst Bob Ney to come share some thoughts. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thank you, Rick.
So who sends the Pope bullets?
I don't know. I mean, it's like sending, the Dalai Lama and that Mother Teresa when she was alive. I mean, who does do that, you know? Unbelievable.
How twisted do you have to be?
Pretty twisted.
Just crazy. The big news today, the Pentagon's going to require all troops to get vaccinated by September 15th. I got to tell you, I would have thought this would have already been done, but evidently not.
No, there was, a policy that was talked about at one time. And then I'm trying to remember what happened. I think it was suggested by, President Biden, when he came in, suggested that it would be, for discussion. I think he said something to that effect publicly. And then the Pentagon took it from there, and then they're going to require mid-September that, all troops be vaccinated, which is a good idea, of course.
Yeah, one of my go-to military experts that I talked to, Rich Ojeda, he said, look, when he was in the military for all those years, they didn't ask. You just lined up, and they hit you with everything from here to there. You didn't even know what they were giving you. I'm surprised that they didn't add this to that.
Yes, my dad was at Great Lakes. He was a pharmacist, maid, or medic, and he used to give shots. And Dad's told me many times, there was just the lines, and he gave one, and the guy next to him gave the next one, and on and on and on. And, it was done. It was World War II.
Yeah.
Of course, they were going to do that. It's like the old days when you used to travel also overseas. You had your yellow vaccination booklet. It was yellow. And that's where you had your cholera, depending where you were going, malaria, malaria pills, depending where you were going. So we've had those before. But the military, usually, yes, they take precautions. They go into situations. When we went into the Mideast, there's some stuff flying around in the Mideast that we don't have here. And I know they, gave preparation for that for people. So I don't think it's unusual that this is happening. I'm a little surprised it took this long.
Yeah, that's where I'm at. Because as Rich, pointed out, he said, look, during his years, he remembers times walking in line with both sleeves lifted up and a butt cheek hanging out. Because they were hitting you with, as you said, one right after the other. So we'll see where it goes. Home Depot now going to require masks of all of their folks, regardless of vaccination status.
Right. In fact, the day before this came out, a Home Depot employee called me, and he said, hey, we're going to be masked up. And I said, what do you think of that? I just wanted to know. And he said he thought it was fine. He's been vaccinated, but he thought it was a good idea. Home Depot has done that. I think you're going to see more places do that. United Airlines sent out an email today. I was a frequent flyer on United Airlines, and an email came out today that all of their crews and employees are going to get vaccinated. Of course, you wear masks on the airplanes, period, but they're going to be vaccinated. I think you're just going to see more and more, of that. And then the one of the unions came out today, teachers unions, and I don't recall which
AFT.
One. Oh, okay. They came out today and were talking about vaccinations.
They're in. Randy Weingarten came out and said she's in favor of
Randy.
Of mandatory Randy. Vaccinations. Becky
right.
Pringle over at NEA still saying it should be voluntary. So
right.
Yeah, we'll see where that goes. Now, I don't know if you saw this Wall Street Journal story that I found quite interesting. This Arkansas nurse, who evidently both her parents died of COVID, didn't get the shot. She's not getting the shot, and she's not regretting it. The only thing that she's regretting, according to her, is that people are blaming her. She said, quote, some people make us feel like it's our fault that the parents are gone. And I'm going, kind of is. Had you gotten them vaccinated, they might still be here.
Right. They were, I think it was, I'm trying to remember, was it September? Or no. That was of last year. I think another issue came up. I don't think it was this lady, but it was somebody else who was a nurse. And it sort of reminds me of the same similar thing where she's still saying, well, okay, they're deceased, but, you know, doesn't regret anything. I don't know how you can say that.
Yeah, now, good. You know, hey, you made your choice. You moved on. Good. Good for the rest of us. But here again, there's this moment where I'm going, you can be stupid for yourself. And, you know, you get sick and you die. In fact, there's a radio host down in Florida. Dick Farrell, I guess his name is. He was a Newsmax guy as well. You know, vehement anti-vaxxer. It was all a hoax until he got it, and then he changed his tune. He's now dead. And I used to go, you know, good, bye. I'm ready to get rid of those people. But now they're, you know, I got a guy who does this kind of modeling, and he's saying, look, you know, we're at a point where potentially we get a variant that jumps the vaccine, and we're right back to square one. So now I'm like, you know, now I'm in this weird spot. Does that make sense?
Yes. I mean, here's the problem, too. People, they're so, you know, stereotyping this whole deal. They'll say, well, what's the use of getting the vaccine when somebody that got the vaccine, Lindsey Graham, you know, for example, got COVID? Well, you know, he's not on a respirator. We can talk about all that, but they're using that example to justify not getting a vaccine.
Yeah.
And if you take that type of thinking up and people just don't get vaccines and they stop, then new strains will come along. And as you say, they will jump the system because not enough people got vaccinated. If more people had been vaccinated, you know, as soon as it was all available and would have continued on with it, I'm not a scientist, but they've pointed out many times, it would contain a lot of the variants. It would not allow them to take a stronger form necessarily. But if you're not vaccinated, then it allows the variants to become stronger and one after the other. It's kind of simple thinking about it.
Very simple. And now you're looking at Arkansas, who evidently had the largest number of COVID hospitalizations since the pandemic began. And you've got their governor going, it was an error, I think is the way he put it. It was an error to sign the law that banned, you know, municipalities or anyone from having mask mandates. He's man enough to admit it now. And I'm like, you know, I guess better late than never. How about you undo it?
Right. Governor Hutchinson, that's one thing about I served with him in Congress. And that is one thing that, you know, at least he's coming out and saying, hey, you know, I thought different and this is what happened. And now he needs to work towards reversing any attitude he had or any cause of problems from that. And then you go down to Florida and there's no second guessing himself down there as a governor, DeSantis.
Yeah,
and that's like a chaotic battle now all over the place in Florida by different groups and the governor and, you know, on and on.
And that's where, you know, you've got, you know, I guess DeSantis came out today that he's saying that the state is going to withhold people's salaries who enact mask mandates. So if you're a local school board, they're going to try and figure out how to, if you're a superintendent, they're going to try and starve you out by taking your salary for protecting people. It's insane.
Right. Yes, he did. He announced if you enforce the mask mandate, then you get your salary withheld. And I don't understand that. You know, more people are putting masks on. I went into a place today, a store, and I put a mask on. I did. I've been vaccinated, but I put a mask on because I thought, okay, what's it gonna hurt to do it? You know,
yeah.
It doesn't.
But it's like anything. I mean, you know, at some point we've got to wake up to the reality of what is. It's just frightening. I mean, because there are hundreds of these stories that we could go through. I mean, in New Orleans, they've canceled the Jazz Fest again. In Florida, they had a church where a bunch of people died. And now, oops, you know, hey, we better do something. Now they're doing a vaccine clinic. There's a bunch of this stuff that you couldn't have learned the easy way. Somebody had to die over it. It's crazy.
Well, also, Rick, there are people I personally know, and they argue within their own families, and their children are calling them saying, you know, get vaccinated. And the answer that they have is, well, I'm allergic to a lot of things. Well, they've been to their doctor. They just won't be honest about the fact that the doctor said, you know, there's no reason you don't get the shot.
Yeah.
But they'll say those types of things. Well, I'm allergic, you know, to a lot of things. So if I get it, I'll die.
Yeah, common
sense.
Well,
if they don't get it and they get the COVID, they will die.
Yeah, allergic to common sense.
Right, exactly.
But here's the thing. How many people tell me, well, you know, 99% of people are going to make it through. It's only that weak 1% or the weak, 0.7% or whatever it is. And they go, yeah, and it could possibly be you. I'm not rolling that dice. Let's move along. A new report out by the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Code red, basically. Code red for humanity.
Well, it is. And it's saying, of course, what we know, that the Earth's climate is getting so hot. Now, this is the scary part. In about a decade, we will probably go past the level of warming that the world leaders have been trying to prevent. That's in a decade, not within 40, 50 years, within 10 years. And what they're saying in the report, and one of the co-authors, Linda Mearns, said it's just guaranteed that it's going to get worse. Not possibly, but guaranteed. And she said nowhere to run and nowhere to hide. So, you know, if you look at this report, and it had some other interesting things in it. It called climate change clearly human-caused. I mean, for the most part, yes, there are certain environmental factors, natural factors. Yes, we all know that. But according to the report, it's mainly human-caused. And then it's talking about more precise, warmer forecasts for the 21st century. And this was issued, the last time this report was issued like this was in 2013. Now they're saying, you know, this is going to be bad forecast, obviously, ahead of, you know, coming down the road for us very quickly here.
Yeah, the part that I found interesting is they're saying, you used to have a heat wave once every 50 years. Now it's turning into once every decade. And they're saying soon it could be, twice every 7 years. So every 3.5 years, we're going to get hit with a once every 50 years heat wave.
Right, and that is the scary part of the report. And again, it goes to where it will happen twice every 7 years, which used to be once every 50. If you look at the numbers, once every 50 versus twice every 7 is a huge change. It's not small. It's something that's just absolutely getting out of control. And so I think it's a warning. They don't get into politics on this. They just lay out what the facts are on the climate problem.
Yeah, but here's some good news today, and this is where I started the show off today, is there's a little bit of good news, a little ray of hope potentially. Maybe we can start turning things around. And I look at the fact that that they're moving on this $3.5 trillion infrastructure thing. They're moving on the $1.2 trillion one in the bipartisan fashion. So we're moving in some direction to do a little bit, something, not near enough, but something, right?
Well, true. And also, there was a little bit of a break with, I think, with some statements, for example, that Senator Capito of West Virginia made, and she's a Republican, and she was talking about, for the first time, the global warming. And so let's see where that goes. But you're right. I mean, this starts with, the infrastructure bill. And I understand the politics of it. And as I was telling somebody on one of their radio shows, I said the phrase, the old bulls, and they're like, who are that? Well, the old bulls are some of the committee chairs. And it was that way when I was in the House, and they were Republican. And there's now some, Democrats in the Senate. And they don't like when it all doesn't go through their committee or that they don't make the call on it. And when it comes to the infrastructure bill, if they're going to sit around, a few of them, and be angry because of jurisdiction or ego or whatever, well, this is going to roll past them because it's coming tomorrow, and it's going to have a big, healthy vote.
Good. We need it. We need the bipartisan plan, but we also need the $3.5 trillion plan that they're moving, hopefully through the budget reconciliation process.
Right.
Do you see both
right.
of them passing? Any chance?
Well, there'll be no Republicans on the $3.5 trillion. Of course, they didn't cut a deal with Senator Schumer that we'll do infrastructure, and then of course we'll vote for that. There wasn't some linkage. They just approached infrastructure separately because they know they needed to get it. But I still think that once, especially particularly Senator Manchin, comes around with his thoughts where the $3.5 trillion ought to be and weighs in on it, I think there's some hope out there that the Democratic side will have the votes they need. They need to hit 50. And if it is compromised a bit and certain things are removed, then they might pick up a couple of Republicans. That's possible.
So you think it's possible to get that $3.5 trillion bill pushed through?
Well, I don't think it'll be $3.5 trillion. If we talk about the $3.5 trillion number, I'm going to handicap that a 30% chance to pass.
Okay.
That's just where I know my friends don't like to hear that. That's just the way it is. Now, if the number's reduced and certain things are maybe altered in there, then I think the stats go up, the odds go up. I don't think as it sits, it's going to happen. Now, people have to make a decision. Do they say, well, it's all or nothing? No, they're going to have to compromise something, I think, probably to at least get two of the Democratic senators' votes. And then people can, be angry at them all day, but a portion of something is better than losing it all.
No, I'm right there with you.
I think.
You got to get something. Because the reality is, next year is not looking good politically for the Democrats. They need a massive win. Because right now all the winds are turning against them. Every time you turn around, with the inflation, the crime rate going up in certain spots, there's a lot of fodder for the Republicans to attack with, and I would like to see something big and bold that's gonna create jobs and get people moving in the right direction.
Well, right now the Republicans are in the driver's seat in a sense, and I've talked with friends of mine who are Democratic, I'll call them consultants, they're the think strategy people, that are working the system. And of course, you hear from Republican consultants too, we everybody talks to each other. And there is a fact that's being admitted, at least behind the scenes, sometimes publicly by the Democratic consultants, that if the election were held today, it wouldn't be good. But they're identifying the areas, and they are areas that can be tackled by the Democratic side. Now, the pandemic, who knows? On that one, you have to, do your best, take your best shot and run with it and try to get people vaccinated, They're saying about the Delta variant, but there's some other issues that I think could be tempered. So, yes, currently at this time, the winds are going towards the Republicans, but it's early. So, we'll have to see what happens.
There you go. Good stuff, Bob. I appreciate the time.
Thanks.
As always, your wealth of knowledge and depth always amazes me. I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Rick.
Good stuff. Our good friend, Bob Ney. Seriously, I'm right now, not a lot of good messaging. Need big win, and this being part of it. Now, there are some good things. The fact that you look at a petition effort has been launched in Nebraska to raise the minimum wage there to $15 an hour by 2026. And I'm going, nice effort. I'm liking the idea, but I think you're a little late because there was just a Washington Post article that had said, for the first time, the average pay of supermarket workers and restaurant workers is now more than $15 an hour. So we've already, gone there. This is where the moment where you go, this is where you need to raise the minimum wage considerably. You need to get to the $15 an hour because they're right. There's some inflation going on. A worker who's working for, you know, 12, 14, 15 bucks an hour has seen their raises being you know, basically chewed away by inflation. We need to make sure that those wages are in place. We also need to peg those for inflation so that wages don't continue to fall backwards. But I thought it was interesting that, you know, they went through this piece about, you know, all of these different these places, Walmart, Target, all of them have you know, jumped right up to the 15 buck mark to make sure that they can compete for workers. And it was one of these things where, you know, it made me think about that whole labor shortage thing. Because they kept throwing out, oh, there's this horrible labor shortage. There's not a labor shortage. There's a wage shortage. And I saw this great cartoon, you know, like two guys sitting in booths. One guy, you know, they both got a sign on their booth saying, you know, hiring. One said, you know, $7.25, and the other one said $15 an hour. And the guy at $7.25 was sitting there by himself going, there's a labor shortage. And the other line is just flush with people because people want to work for a reasonable wage. It seems sane to me. This is not rocket science. It doesn't take a genius to figure it out. Now, some interesting numbers. 2012 is when the Fight for 15 campaign found its early roots. In fact, we had groups from New York and Chicago come on. They were the beginnings of what became the Fight for 15 in a union campaign. But according to the National Employment Law Project, that since that 2012 beginning, some 26 million workers have seen an additional $150 billion in raises. People of color saw an additional $76 billion in wages, and women workers an extra $70 billion. That's what making demands will get you. And I keep coming back to this. You can't go in individually and beg for pennies. You have to stand together and beg and fight for dollars. It seems kind of commonsensious, kind of like a bit of common sense. But something maybe need to relearn again. So for me, the reality, we're in a moment where wages are going up because it's a little tight labor pool, still got the after effects of the pandemic. But now is the time to make sure that this is permanent. Because what we saw during the pandemic is employers giveth and they taketh away. Which again, another reason why I say you need a union contract. Make sure it's in writing. And, you know, we'll see. We'll see what happens in the next year if we get to the other side of this pandemic. So again, I come back to, you know, if you're not vaccinated, do it. We're going back to doing the social distancing. We're going back to doing the masks. We're going back to doing the things that we thought we had gotten past. Do it. If we're big boys and girls, if we do what is right, what we know works. It's not rocket science. Stay away from people. Wash your mitts. You know, slap some cloth over your face and protect yourself. Not that hard to figure out. Just have to do it. We have to be a little more diligent. And then we'll get to the other side. The fear, and this is where, you know, my listener who sends me these horrific models, you know, keeps coming back to, you know, had we just done the right thing at the beginning? Had we just been more patient at the beginning? Instead of having, you know, people, you know, running around screaming at the Capitol and holding COVID parties so they all get it, we'd be through this by now. We'd be already on the other side of it. So still time to grow up, still time to act your age, still time to stop being petulant. Anyway, if you missed any of today's program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go, wherever you go. And as always, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.